I want to take this opportunity to introduce my dear colleague, Rabbi David Gottlieb, who will be dealing with how to deal with issues, among them feminism. I don't think. Rabbi Gottlieb.
I don't know if it's good form to start by contradicting the introduction, but I don't believe what I have to say is more important than understanding how to mekayim avas Hashem. I don't believe it's more important. Feminism is a wide issue. It's not deep. There's nothing deep in it, but it's wide. It covers a lot of ground. It's like a disease spreading through the body. And I can only pick out a few elements. I should tell you that the textbook on the subject is Jewish Woman in Jewish Law by Rabbi Moshe Meiselman. It's been in print for 40 years since he first put it out, and is the textbook on the subject. A follow-up book called The Woman in Jewish Law and Tradition by Rabbi Kaufman in the Old City. He builds on Rabbi Meiselman's themes, and he adds some historical and social material, which is very useful. If you want a background on the subject, I would recommend those two books, starting with Rabbi Meiselman's book. A great deal of what I say I've taken from Rabbi Meiselman's book. Over the last 40 years or 50 years of the feminist movement, there have really been two strains, two types of feminist thinking and activity. One is there are no differences between men and women. There are no essential, built-in, root differences between men and women. The only differences that you see are imposed by culture. Choices made by people to act in certain ways, to selectively program their children in certain ways, but in terms of the actual nature of men and women, there's no essential difference. The other recognizes that there are differences, but claims that the way men and women are treated, in particular the way women are treated, does not adequately address their true character. It doesn't take account of what they, as unique individuals, need, deserve, have a right to, and in particular, the way they are treated exploits them. There's a big difference between the two types. If you're dealing with the, one or another of the two types, it makes a big difference. If you are confronting a person who thinks there are no differences between men and women, I admit to you that's more than slightly insane, but there are people like that, even to this day. It follows, if there are no essential differences between men and women, that any culture that describes different roles for men and women must be wrong. Whatever the differences are, and however they're conceived, if men and women don't have any essential differences, then there shouldn't be any prescribed difference in role that they should play. All positions in society should be equally open to men and women. There shouldn't be selective values, selective emphasis, like the early kibbutz, which created its own literature of women driving tractors and baling hay, and men cooking in the kitchen and tending the children, to make it clear that there are no differences inherently in men and women, and therefore there should be no differences in roles or preferences for the place they should play in society. Obviously, that position is grossly inconsistent with the Torah's picture of the world. The second strain, where differences between men and women are recognized, and the claim is only that the way women are treated isn't consistent with their real nature and their real needs, that's much easier to deal with, because identifying the real differences between men and women is a difficult job. And it's a job which, at best, is still greatly in progress. A great deal yet has to be exposed. Many differences and similarities that people thought were correct have been revised over the years. At that, to such a feminist, we can say, UIC recognizes there are differences between men and women. We claim that we know what the differences really are, and we claim that the roles that we set, that are set up within the Torah for men and women address those differences accurately, fairly, so that each of the two has an opportunity to develop to their maximum capacity in the areas of life that really count, which of course are the ruchniyistic areas. But when you're dealing with the subject, it's important to distinguish between the two types of feminism, and in particular dealing with a person or a group, to know what their prejudices are, whether they are prejudiced in favor of the first or the second. Now, if you meet someone who represents the first type of feminism, there are a few reflections you can offer which hopefully will cause them to think again. There are obvious physical differences between men and women, not only in the reproductive system, but there is a hormone called testosterone, which is linked to aggressive behavior. And on the average, men have 20 times as much testosterone in the body as women. Indeed, some of the cleverer feminists say that men suffer from testosterone poisoning, because it's responsible for a great deal of men's aggressive behavior, like war and motorcycle racing and bungee jumping and other kinds of odd behavior. Furthermore, the brain is not structured the same way for men and women. The corpus callosum, which joins the left and right hemispheres of the brain, is larger and better developed in women than in men. And studies of brain activity show that when performing the same tasks, men's and women's brains perform them differently. For example, men's brains are more lateralized than women's. Language is on the left, and mathematics is on the right. When women process language, the processing is to a certain extent distributed over the whole brain, whereas for men it's not true. So I suppose hormones and the structure of the brain and the brain functioning do have something to contribute to your character, your perception, your basic focus, the way you respond to the world. And since they are different, systematically different between men and women, to say that there are no interesting differences is, of course, absurd. By the way, all the research done into the difference between men and women, almost all, is done by women. Because if a man did the research, they wouldn't accept it. That's science. And then there are systematic differences between women's and men's character and abilities, certain types of perceptual abilities, certain types of problem solving. They did studies of how men and women memorize routes to get from one place to another. Turns out that men are sensitive to the geometry of the route, and women are sensitive to the cues on the way. You know, what things are in the environment as you're passing from stage to stage. And if you think that this difference is really motivated by culture, well, they did the same studies on rats. And male rats are more sensitive to the geometry, and female rats are more sensitive to the cues along the way. I doubt that human culture is affecting the abilities of rats. There's been a study of autism, one set of studies shows that women's brains are more naturally strong at and focused on empathy for others, and men are more strong at and invested in systematizing abstractly. And this accounts for the fact that one hypothesis that autism is simply a super masculine brain. It's lacking almost entirely in the ability to empathize with others, and therefore they don't read others' moods and attitudes and gestures. And it's a factor of the male side of the brain being dominant, the female side of the brain being grossly underdeveloped. So the claim that there are no differences is simply inconsistent with the facts about the body and certain psychological capabilities. There was a study done of the kibbutz, a very interesting study by an American sociologist, In the first generation of the left-wing kibbutzim, as we said, there were no differences between boys and girls. They lived together in the same dorms, and they were assigned to the same tasks, and they created a whole literature of picturing women doing equally men's roles, is what we would call men's roles, and men doing women's roles. And in the first generation of the kibbutz, indeed, the roles were split by the males and the females about equally. In the second generation, the division started to appear. By the third generation, the division of roles, traditional division of roles, and the division of roles in the outside society was reenacted within the kibbutz. In other words, they failed to produce children in two generations of training and ideology and semi-exclusion from the outside world. They failed to produce children who would naturally fit into both roles equally. There was an interview with a woman on the kibbutz, and they asked her, you've been here through this period, you've observed this development, how do you explain the fact that you've created a culture and a set of values and a whole literature and a whole society in which there's no difference between men and women, and now in the third generation, the differences have reappeared? She said something very, very profound. She said, it seems for you men that going out into the fields and piling up hay and coming back with aching muscles and full of sweat does something for you. You seem to identify with that meaningful to you. As a woman, I just don't see anything in it. When I deal with a child and I see the child grow and I see the child develop and I have an input into the development of a child, to me, that's thrilling. To me, that's fulfilling. But in the outside society, there's a discrimination against women's roles because women aren't given honor and respect for their roles. They're treated as second-class roles. Of course, no one wants to feel second-class. No one wants to feel that people don't respect them. But on the kibbutz, every role is respected. The kibbutz bus driver is respected as much as the kibbutz economist. If every role is respected, why shouldn't I do what I like? I like to deal with children. I have no interest, no identification, no satisfaction from coming home from the fields with aching muscles full of sweat. And that was a very profound remark. In other words, she's acknowledging that naturally there's a division in inclination, a division in identification of different roles. And once you're respected for what you do, no matter what it is, then why shouldn't the person do that which he identifies with and finds meaningful? Now, if we move to the more reasonable, more is only comparative, right? From zero reason to one reason out of 100, that there are differences between men and women, and the complaint is that they're not being treated correctly, they're not being treated with in appropriate fashion. Here, it pays to look at examples of where people play different roles, but are regarded as of equal value. To get an idea of how that's done, to get an idea of how we make that judgment, that even though the roles are different, the values are equal. Take, for example, a violin and a piano playing a sonata. A violin and piano are very different instruments. They produce very different kinds of sounds. Still, in the most central classical music, the violin and the piano are playing equally important roles. We don't say that one is more important than the other because one's a violin and one's a piano. We honor them equally. We treat them with equal value. They make different contributions. If you take, in the United States government, take a Supreme Court justice and the attorney general. They have very different roles. Could anyone say that one role is more important than the other role? The fact that the roles are different doesn't necessarily mean that there's a difference in value. But more than that, when you ask whether there's a difference in value, you must first consider what values are you talking about. With respect to what values are you going to measure whether one role has more value than the other? With respect to Los Angeles values? These roles were created, if you speak to them, you can say, these roles were created within a culture, within a philosophy, within a worldview, and the roles were created to make equal, make roles of equal value with respect to the values of that culture, with respect to the values of that philosophy. We're no surprise to find out that men's and women's roles don't create equal value in Los Angeles philosophy. It wasn't designed for that philosophy. The only true test is to take men's and women's roles within Torah and compare them with Torah values. Because if a person says that it's unfair because women's roles don't allow them to realize equal Los Angeles value, we could challenge the critic by asking, why are you attached to Los Angeles values? What makes you think Los Angeles values are real? Or any more real than any other values? And especially if you're dealing with someone who's modern and considers himself to be educated and in sync with the current philosophy, every culture has its values. Why should our roles not fit the values of our culture? Why should it be judged by its inability to fit the values of your culture? Why would that make it discriminatory? You might say, I don't choose to participate in a culture with those values, but you have no critique of the values. Can you show that your values are more correct than the values of the Torah? Especially if you are a modern secular person, you're committed to the idea that every culture has its own values and one culture cannot criticize the values of another culture. So, of course, the goal will be to show that men and women can realize equal Torah value in their lives. Well, how do we measure the Torah value of a life? It's a widespread throughout Mishonim and Achronim. The most successful life a person can have is to be a Novi. Nevuah is absolute dveikus in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, whether you take this from the Rambam or you take it from Rav Chaim Lutzato, or the most valuable achievement in Ruchnius is to be a Novi. Well, Chazal tell us that from the time of Matan Torah until beginning of Ayasheni, there were 1,200,000 Nevim, not including those who left Mitzrayim. Kiflaim Yotze Mitzrayim. And the Medrash says that it was 600,000 men and 600,000 women. So it seems that this greatest of human successes in Ruchnius is equally open to men and to women, if equal numbers achieved it. Mises Nashika, the death of a kiss, like the Hazal say, like pulling a hair out of a glass of milk. The Neshama separates from the body with that kind of ease because the Neshama has become so Ruchni, and the body also participates in the Ruchnius of the Neshama. That's important, though it's a footnote. That pulling the soul out of the body is like pulling a hair out of a glass of milk. There were three people who are on record. Of course, there were more. We may not know about them, but there were three people on record who achieved that Mises Nashika, and they were Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam. So, if you're talking about the goal of life and the value that you can achieve with your life, it seems the value is open equally to men and to women. And that means that whatever the roles are and however the roles work, B'sofo shel dover, bottom line analysis, bottom line evaluation, they do achieve equal value. Okay, I want to take you through a couple of examples of the kinds of complaints that we get, which are common, and show you that usually they're based on mistaken fact and poor logic. And Rabbi Meisman and Rabbi Kaufman go through these examples in great detail. Let's take a little one which everybody worries about. Shelo asani isha. How is it that a man makes a bracha? The question will say, thanking God for not making me a woman. Doesn't that imply directly that women are inferior to men? Now the truth is, as everyone knows, there are three brachos. Shalos ani isha, shalos ani eved, shalos ani goy. And they're made negative. First you have to ask, why are these categories chosen and why is it made negative? If you don't know the answers to those questions, you don't know what the text says. And if you don't know what the text says, then politics and anthropology and sociology and psychology and all the rest are premature. You don't know what you're dealing with. They all three could have been made positive. She'asani Yisrael, she'asani ben Chorin, she'asani Ish. So the explanation that's most common is this. The categories are categories of mitzvos. When you get up in the morning, you make Birchas HaShachar. Birchas HaShachar, you're thanking Kodesh Baruch Hu for making your world, putting you into the world in a certain position, giving you all sorts of kochos, all sorts of abilities to function. These three brachos are not thanking Kodesh Baruch Hu for making my world. They're describing my responsibilities. There are many different systems of mitzvos. Where do I fit? Am I subject to the 65 or so mitzvos that B'nai Noach are subject? It's not seven categories. No, I'm shayach to the Israel side of the ledger. Well, am I what Chazal call a Ben Bris, which could be an Eved Kenani? No, I'm not an Eved Kenani. Okay, so I'm a male, free Jew. There are about 20 mitzvos that are preferentially addressed to men over women. Where do I stand with respect to those mitzvos? If I don't say any more than the fact that I am an adult Jew, so then those mitzvahs are left ambiguous. Am I responsible for them or not? So a man goes on to say that he's male. A woman doesn't say it because it isn't true. She has correctly identified the mitzvahs that apply to her by saying that she is an adult free Jew. I'll come to Shasani Kirson in a moment. Now, what about the fact that it's made in the negative? So the explanation that's given is this. If I say Shasani Yisrael, the question will be raised. You identify as a Yisrael. You proclaim that you are a Yisrael. Are you successful as a Yisrael? Are you being mekayim, the mitzvos that belong to Yisrael? Are you living up to what the challenge of Yisrael is? If you aren't, how do you proclaim positively that you are as Yisrael? Why aren't you embarrassed? Why aren't you shamed by the fact that you are Yisrael and you're failing to live up to it? For that reason, I don't say it positively. I say it negatively. Shalom asani goy. Everybody knows the law of double negation. If you didn't make me a non-Jew, so of course I'm a Jew. But I can't say that. I can't bring myself to proclaim it. The same with Shalom asani isha. I'm a man. I have responsibility for those extra 20 mitzvos. Am I living up to those 20 mitzvos? I'm not living up to them. So then I have to say it by indirection. I have to say it negatively. I think once you take into account that that's what the text means, to make politics out of it is not easy or impossible. Now, Shasani Kirtzono, a klutz kasha is, how does she make it in the positive if all the other brachos are in the negative? I hope that's obvious to you, that's not a kasha, because Shasani Kirtzono isn't describing her responsibilities, it's describing her bria, it's describing her essential character. That goes together with all the other brachos to describe Pochayechim and Al Bisharum and all the rest. So of course it can be positive. But what does it mean? Shasani Kirtzono, he has made me according to his will. Was there another choice? Kodesh Baruch Hu would make something, someone, not according to his will? According to somebody else's will? Why isn't Shasani Kirtzono just redundant? Of course everything Kodesh Baruch Hu does, he does Birtzono. This phraseology we have very often, you can look it up, at the first bracha before Shema at night, when you take the Sefer Torah out on Shabbos morning, in Kaddish, if you don't have the Nusach HaGra, the world that he created according to his will. So we have this phraseology very often. What does it mean? It means he created me in such a way that I naturally do his will. Not robotically, not mechanically, but I have a natural tendency, a natural natia to do his will. A woman says that and a man doesn't because it's true for a woman and not true for a man. Perhaps this is the bini yaseira, shenitna leisha, like Chazal say. A woman has in her something that orients her and focuses her towards doing HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will that a man doesn't have. And that's why she says it and a man doesn't. I think when you see the three brachas of that in that way, there's not much left that you can criticize. I'd like to try. I hope I can finish this in the time. In terms of Talmud Torah, the complaint that you will hear is that women are forbidden to learn Torah, and since they're forbidden to learn Torah, so then that means that they must be inferior in intellect to men. And that complaint is very widely publicized. So the Rambam writes like this: Isha shalom de Torah yesh la schar. Aval enik schar ha'ish v'bnei shalonet staves. V'hala osa dover she'ene b'tzuva alav ein scharo kischar ha'metzuva she'osa ela pochos mimenu. V'aval pi she'yesh la schar tzivu chachamim shalo yilamed adam es bito Torah v'bnei she'rov hanashim ein datan mechuvenes lihislamed Pain motzin divrei Torah le divrei Havai lefi aniyus da'atan. Now, let's learn it up the way our Rambam deserves to be learned. First of all, Ishi Shalom the Torah yesh laschar. That means midiraisa, a woman has schar for learning Torah. All Torah. There's no distinction here made between different types of Torah. A woman has schar for learning all Torah. That includes Rabbi Kiveger. If she has schar, if a Kodesh Baruch will give her schar for doing that, it can't be an avera, deraisa. It also can't be futile. It can't be that she's incapable of understanding it. If you're incapable of understanding it, then she shouldn't do it and she shouldn't get schar for it. She should do the things she's capable of, not the things she's incapable of. But the Rambam starts by saying, yesh la schar. Then he says she has less schar than an ish because she's an eina mitzvah va'osa. Now we know very well, eina mitzvah va'osa is a category of many mitzvahs. The Rambam introduces it here. One should ask, why is it introduced here? What's its special relevance here? It's a Mishnah Torah about who gets more schar and who gets less schar. Is that a normal topic in the Mishnah Torah? She's an eina mitzvah va'osa. But she blibes someone whom HaKadosh Baruch Hu has offered to get a schar for a mitzvah. Like a man on sukkahs who will go into the sukkah to eat an apple, he will get schar for kiyum mitzvah sukkah. It's not chayiv to do that. You can eat the apple outside the sukkah. You come into the sukkah, and most poskim hold, you make a brach on the sukkah. Some hold it for even walking into the sukkah. We don't treat that as trivial or insignificant, and we don't treat it as incompetent or a throwaway. No, and he's telling us that a woman who learns Torah is in the same category. But Tzivu chachamim shelo yelamed adam es bito Torah. He's quoting a Mishnah. So, a man can teach any other woman Torah? His wife, his cousins, open up a school just as long as his daughter isn't in the class? No. Obviously, the tzivu is that there shouldn't be Talmud Torah for women. But then why does the Mishnah, and the Rambam copying the Mishnah, talk about teaching his daughter Torah? Why is that the paradigm? Is somehow your daughter the binyan am for all the women in the world? It's very hard to understand. And why not? Why shouldn't women be taught Torah? B'pnei sh'rov nashim ein datan mechuvenes l'hislamed. Most women, their das is not focused and aimed at learning. Why isn't it mechuvan? What makes it lo mechuvan? The Rambam doesn't say, but he does imply by saying, rov nashim. Rov nashim. Not all. If he had meant all, he could have just left out the word rov and said nashim. He says rov nashim. That means the miyut is not so. If there's a miyut that's not so, then it means it's not part of a Kodesh Baruch Hu's bria that women aren't mechuvan. If it were part of a Kodesh Baruch Hu's bria of women that they're not mechuvan, then they would all be that way. There wouldn't be exceptions. So what explains why they aren't focused in this way? So some of Orshim say it's what he said at the beginning of the halacha. Since she has less schar isn't just a question of, I want to pile up a good olam haba. We're supposed to try to serve a Kodesh Baruch Hu lishma. But if a Kodesh Baruch Hu gave less schar, if it's einamu tzuba va'osa, like the Rishonim say, that means a Kodesh Baruch Hu made that a secondary mitzvah. It's not a primary mitzvah. I have to know what a Kodesh Baruch Hu wants from me. There are a lot of rules, but then they aren't all equal. Some are more important, some are less important. Obviously, I should make my greatest investment in the rules that a Kodesh Baruch Hu says are most important for me, not the ones that he says are least important for me. So women realizing that Talmud Torah for them is a secondary rule, a secondary opportunity, don't focus themselves on Talmud Torah. They don't do it because in terms of Ruchnius, it's not the place for them. And they know that. Now, once their das is not focused on Islamid, you come to the final terrible consequence, and that is you know from your own experience, to become competent in learning a Gemara takes years. It takes years of sustained effort. A person who doesn't put that kind of effort into learning Torah Sheval Peh isn't going to understand it. If he isn't going to understand it, then he isn't going to respect it, and he isn't going to follow it. And he will interpret it in ways that are Hagadol Shel Dofi. He's going to make it into a joke. A friend of mine interviewed a woman who was at the Hebrew Union College in Yerushalayim, and she told him that she was taking a Talmud course, which is optional for them, optional. And the teacher said in the first session, I've chosen tractate Sukkah because that tractate shows clearly just how foolish the Talmud is. And they spent a semester showing how foolish the Talmud is. Well, listen, I could do the same thing for physics. Take a person who has no background in physics and give him 3 50-minute lectures for 14 weeks. I know enough that's weird about physics to make him feel that the whole subject is a joke. The whole subject is just ridiculous. You all know about cause and effect. A causes B. Can you imagine cases where the effect comes first? Before the cause? Before the cause that makes it happen, the effect is already done? There are cases where, in modern physics, they say that that's true. Now, I'm sure that sounds very weird. It is very weird. That's the way physics is. I can give you 3 dozen examples like that, and you can walk away and say, gosh, physics is just a joke. It's a joke. These people aren't serious. They aren't sane. He could do the same thing with Talmud in one semester. So could you. You find enough things which require deep understanding and present them superficially, the person won't get it. So this is the danger. The danger is that a woman will not make the investment. She won't make the investment because as ruchnius, she knows it's not right to make the investment. And then her understanding will be so impoverished that she will interpret the ideas in ways that will be inappropriate. And her ruchnius will suffer, and the people whom she talks to will suffer. And the Torah Tumima on the Pasuk in Dvarim, which says that you shouldn't teach your daughter Torah, brings a tshuva from one of the late Rishonim who says, and if you'll have a woman who's an exception, then it is permissible to teach her Torah. Because she doesn't fit the description that the Rambam makes. But, to finish, why does it say your daughter? Because what you do with your children teaches them values. What you choose to do with your child teaches them what's valuable. And it's not just that you are teaching women in the street, but you're teaching your daughter. Your daughter's going to grow up and think, this is what my father invested in me. This is what my father did with me. So it's important. And she's going to learn that her life depends upon Talmud Torah. And that's a sheker. That's a great sheker. It's an eina mitzvah v'osa at best for a woman. That's one way to teach the idea of Talmud Torah. It's an example of how, once you study the halacha in detail, learn it up with lumdus the way any good halacha should be learned, and apply it with correct logic, then the critique that we often hear is simply incorrect. This is just a Rashi Prakim to give you the theme of the study, and those who are interested can take a look at those 2 books that I mentioned and get some very good valuable information from it.